Welcome to episode 6 of Rise, a special Eastern Standard series inspired by flooding in eastern Kentucky. Most recently, on the night of last July 27th and into the morning of the 28th.
This time it came in the middle of the night.
It hit like at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was dark anyway. Then the power went out. And the only thing that they could hear was they could hear the water, they couldn't see the water. And then they could hear the voices of people crying out for help, but you couldn't help them because you didn't know where they were.
About 6 a.m. that morning, we realized that the water was getting higher and higher.
I've had so many people say that, they either didn't leave, they didn't evacuate, they didn't move things because it had never been, so high before.
Hearing and seeing the water was just beyond our comprehension. Couldn't get over it, couldn't believe how much water was coming out of these hills so fast.
It was high enough on the level in the garage that it was going into the electrical outlets.
Now, water comes from different directions, north and south, both all at once. I've never even thought I'd ever be in such a situation.
We'll be trying to get our heads around this for a long time. It's really disturbing.
Mandy Scheffel, Mindy Miller, Tracy Goff, Laura Thomas, Seth Long, Kathy Jones, Sean North, Bev May, survivors of the flash flood of last July in eastern Kentucky that, in the middle of the night as people slept, quickly transformed tranquil 6-inch creeks into raging 30-foot rivers. 45 lives were lost. Thousands of homes and buildings were severely damaged or totally destroyed. It's been 6 months since it happened. People are still without homes. Some businesses have remained closed. The years-long process of recovery is underway, and out of grief, loss, heartache, and misery, some opportunities for a better future for the people of Appalachian Kentucky are beginning to appear. Eastern Standard and the Rise series are produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this episode...
As devastating as it is, there can be good things that come afterward.
As horrible as it is, we have to make lemonade out of this lemon because you can take bad situations and hopefully good things can come of it.
That's the definition of being successful, is finding opportunities in difficult situations.
I think this experience has changed everybody that was affected by the flood, and not just, directly, but, everybody that went through that July 28th and seen the aftermath. But we are very resilient here in eastern Kentucky, and we will build back. I think this is a great opportunity for us to make things better.
And in the dozens of interviews for this series, we've heard a persistent theme.
The impacts of the flood have brought attention particularly to the housing issue.
An issue that has for a long time been an impediment to the region's well-being and growth.
Our housing market is broken fundamentally.
We need more housing and we need it quick.
We deserve safe, decent, affordable housing just like everyone else.
This is going to be sort of what makes the difference, in my view, whether this housing is ends up being rebuilt or not.
Why housing is key.
Population loss is one of our number one kind of macro issues that SOAR wants to keep in focus, because it is, without people, nothing really works.
I have heard figures that maybe 20% of our population we might be losing. I hope that's wrong.
So how does this shortage of places to live impact prospects for strengthening the regional economy? Jim King with the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises.
Any sort of policy that you might enact to revitalize a community or a region can't have the luxury of saying, well, what we just need are more jobs. Well, okay, jobs have to have places to live. People have to go home at night. If you're going to attract industry, you have to have strong schools. You have to have good health care options for people.
J.R. Sanderson, disaster recovery expert with the nonprofit St. Bernard Project.
If a community doesn't recover, people just get up and leave. And when people get up and leave, you lose your tax base. And when you lose your tax base, now all of a sudden I don't have money for schools, for fire departments, for for sidewalks or anything, right? I've lost my tax base. And we've seen that happen across America.
So with the State General Assembly in non-budgetary session, how likely is it that there will be immediate state funding for housing? WEKU's Stu Johnson caught up with Senate President Robert Stivers in the Capitol hallway to ask if there's been any forward motion.
There's been some, and there's been various meetings, you know, talking about sequencing and how you put monies out there, land acquisition, infrastructure, all those items have to be considered in an overall plan. I'm not sure from some of the people we inquired of if they have come back with some of the information we are wanting, such as where you would potentially relocate or try to attempt to change housing patterns, acquisition of land, water, sewer, those various items that have to be there. Because I'll just give you a for instance. It's one thing to be in the city where you can hook up to local sewer. It's another to be on a man-made plateau of a strip mine. So you have to look, is the infrastructure there, water, sewer? If there is not sewer or water, can you get them there? And it's much easier to get water than it is sewer. So if you can't get sewer there, does the land do what we call perk, where you can put septic systems in there? So there's a lot of planning that has to go into this, and we're waiting for some answers as it relates to all those planning pieces. I wish it was as simple as saying, here's money, go build a house, but it's not.
There are two things that make something happen, money and power.
Jerry Roll, executive director of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, has been keeping pressure on the state legislature.
If the community doesn't have the money, then they don't have the power to address the issues that they know they have. They're living here. So if our community is telling us loud and clear that housing is our top number one priority, we need places to live. We need to have the money as a community to use our power to build these communities.
The question that has everyone's attention, where do we go from here?
We have to come together and think about what is our regional vision.
The Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky's Jerry Roll.
It doesn't mean our communities can't have a plan themselves and put it into place, but if we do that, thinking about how it all plays into a bigger regional vision, we're going to have a lot better luck, not only finding the resources to pull it all together, but in being successful in doing it, because we will have this plan in place. So one of the things we're going to do at the foundation is we're talking to the University of Kentucky and thinking about how do we put that plan together so that people can have something not to put on the shelf, but a living document to think about, well, this is what Letcher County has pulled together, and Perry County and Knott County and Breathitt County. And then we can hold that towards this bigger, you know, this is what it's going to take to do the housing across the region. This is what it will take, you know, to pull these economic development plans together. So it is an inflection point, and I think it is going to prove to be our, I don't know, wake-up call is too harsh, because I think people here have been aware, but now we are vividly aware that moving forward is not going to be like looking back.
As head of the Kentucky Economic Development Association, Haley McCoy is looking forward.
We are learning not to sell ourselves short because of our geographic location or limitations. Our beautiful topography is no longer an isolating thing. We can be just as connected as anyone else. So I think that there's room to explore.
Connectivity. If housing is priority one, and by all accounts it is, bringing the region into a 21st century online economy is a close second. Colby Hall with Shaping Our Appalachian Region, or SOAR.
Yeah, it's the internet, and it's the opportunities, the economic, the healthcare, the education opportunities that come with the internet. And I don't want to rehash what everybody knows, right, as a result of the pandemic and how important the internet is. But it's essential infrastructure. I get it. You know, you're not going to drink the internet the way that you drink water. You're not going to flip the light, you know, electricity, those other utilities, they're all unique. But I would wager to bet that the internet is becoming as important as those, and that, you know, you may only be able to go 24 hours without water, and you can definitely go longer than 24 hours without internet, but it would really stunt the economic future of communities if they don't have that infrastructure. So despite the carnage of this last round of floods and the amount of individual and community loss and buildings, I am not trying to, what I'm about to say, take away from that, because if we could all do it over again and not get the internet done and save those lives and the property, you choose the people over anything 100%. So don't mishear me here. But in a lot of ways, when you're starting from a blank slate, Tom, there's a silver lining to even a natural disaster like that. And I think the internet and the infrastructure is one thing. So as you're rebuilding and you're having to put in new telephone poles and hang new lines and put in new water infrastructure, go ahead and lay some fiber down, lay some conduit down. I mean, I know it's harder than that, Tom, but I can't imagine that there would be a better opportunity while you're already in the ground or you're up in the air to go ahead and do a little bit of marginal extra work to get that done.
We know it can be done. Joshua Ball, Chief Operating Officer at SOAR.
If you look in Eastern Kentucky, a lot of the real success stories of broadband have been in counties like Jackson and Owsley that are served by People's Rural Telephone Cooperative, where they were the first gigabit county in the state of Kentucky. So I think progress is being made, and I think the state and federal government have unprecedented levels of funding available, grant dollars available for communities to really position themselves and plan for this last mile broadband deployment, because it's more than just broadband. It's really a lifeline, and it's also a huge job recruiting tool as we begin to talk about remote work for not only the people of Eastern Kentucky, but people that are leaving metropolitan areas and urban centers to move to more rural locations because they can essentially bring their job with them.
The Jackson County town of McKee, population 800, where Haley McCoy is from, is home to the People's Fiber Network, a high-speed fiber optic internet service to rival any big city. McKee is the hub of a 1,000-mile fiber-to-home network covering two of the nation's poorest and most remote counties. Between 2014, when the network was completed, and 2022, unemployment in the county has, with the exception of the early months of the pandemic in 2020, has been in steady decline. Today, residents of Owsley and Jackson counties work online, mostly from home, for companies like Amazon, Hilton, and Apple. The fiber link was built almost entirely with dollars from the Biden administration's infrastructure plan. Change can be difficult to accept unless you're given no choice but to adapt. Was the flood of last July that powerful? Does it represent a true turning point for Eastern Kentucky? Or was it something else, less defined? That's been on the mind of Special Topics reporter Chris Begley.
Do the recent floods in Eastern Kentucky represent a turning point for the region? That question sounds very dramatic, a turning point, the moment when everything changes. But there are all kinds of turning points. There were the first people to arrive in the region many thousands of years ago. Then other groups of people arrived from Europe and Africa, which transformed everything. The development of industry in the region was a turning point. Long before coal, there was salt, iron, and hogs. This all developed in the early 1800s. They all declined in the mid-1800s. That was a big turning point. There was the advent of the extractive industries in the late 1800s, coal and timber. Then the collapse of the timber industry in the early 20th century. Well, maybe collapse isn't the right word. They just cut it all down, with small exceptions like Lily Cornet Woods or Blanton Forest. There was the decline of the coal industry, with a drop in employment because of the development of surface mining and mechanization. then the decline because of alternative fuels that most everybody think are better options. This one we witnessed, and it seems especially significant, but it's part of a pattern. Both the rusty tipple and the abandoned iron furnaces are skeletal reminders of previous changes. So we may be at a turning point, but we're on a curvy mountain road where the turns keep coming. And if this is a turning point, a significant turning point, what do we see as we face the new direction? Do we keep waiting for the next industry to replace salt, iron, hogs, timber, and coal? Are we setting our hopes on attracting something from somewhere else? And is that realistic? My connection to the region is based on family and history and memories. People and places mean something to me because of that. What if you don't have that? And many of these industries demanded a high price from the region and its people. Will the next one as well? Will it be prisons, rare earth metals, tourism? And is industry the best answer? Maybe something homegrown and small scale. History seems to suggest that nothing lasts too long, and that these turning points are the rule, not the exception. We're talking about floods here, but we're clearly talking about more than that, too. These floods occurred in a specific context, and those details determine how they affect people and how we should respond. I'm not sure this is a turning point. It's more like a curve that we've been navigating for some time now.
In a moment, navigating that curve. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Rise, a production of Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu. This episode of Rise concludes our special six-week series airing weekly on Eastern Standard. The series explores the aftermath of Eastern Kentucky flooding, how communities are responding, and what's needed to address the challenges ahead. The Rise series will take a short break and then resume airing once a month. While we will follow flood recovery efforts, we will also broaden our scope to include other issues affecting Eastern Kentucky. To learn more about the series schedule, suggest a topic, or listen to episodes on demand, visit weku-rise.org. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
As Chris Begley pointed out, Eastern Kentucky has been through more than a few changes. The most recent paradigm shift began coming into clearer focus only in the past decade. Bailey Richards, Hazards Downtown Coordinator.
I moved here right at kind of the tail end of coal being the still major dominant employer and economic driver in the area. I moved here in 2011, and there was still big push for coal is still the future. Coal is still going to be the continued driver. And there was still a lot of that happening. But the tide was starting to turn that, no, we really need to kind of diversify. It can be a part of our economy, but it certainly can't be the whole economy anymore. And so that was 12 years ago. And to now, we see that, you know, we have a vastly different situation going on.
How vast? In 2019, the think tank Energy Innovation found that 70% of coal-fired power plants were more expensive to operate compared to the alternative of building new wind and solar. That share has now grown to 99%, with only a plant in Wyoming standing in the way of 100%. The shift, according to the authors of the report, is due in large part to the Inflation Reduction Act signed in August, which has several incentives that make wind and solar less expensive. The Kentucky Lantern, citing data from the Kentucky Office of Energy Policy, is reporting that 13 county fiscal courts in seven cities across the state, some in eastern Kentucky, now have a process and rules for implementing solar projects for both small-scale rooftop solar installations and utility-scale solar. The Kentucky Resources Council, the nonprofit environmental advocacy group, has created a model ordinance for regulating solar installations that local communities can use in coming up with their own regulations. As you've heard earlier in this hour, Eastern Kentucky, four of its counties in particular, Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry, has been through a natural disaster on a scale that's forcing the people of the region, those four counties in particular, to concentrate on their future. First and foremost, figuring out how to prepare for the possibility of more extreme weather, but also what needs to happen to nurture communities. Complicating the planning is the uncertainty of climate change and whether extreme events such as the floods of 2020 and 21 and the storm that stalled over eastern Kentucky last July are becoming more frequent. As we heard in an earlier episode from Stephanie Herring at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the search for answers continues.
The question that this work is really focused on addressing is not this binary, did climate change have or not have an effect? It's not a yes or no answer that this field of research is trying to get at. It's the how much has the risk changed? Why has the risk changed? And what do decision makers need to know about their future risk so they can plan for some of these extremes?
I think that makes planning really hard.
Soars Colby Hall.
You know, long-term planning, especially in areas where it could happen. I think a business person or anybody looking at making any type of investment in one of our counties that's been hit really hard recently by flooding, they're rightfully, you know, thinking, well, is it worth the risk? So I think it makes anything in the long term really, really hard.
Jeff Marietta heads Invest 606 and the Appalachian Impact Fund.
In the conversations that I have, people understand that the weather is becoming more volatile with, you know, more significant storms and chances for flooding. And so I'd be hard pressed to talk to anybody out here who spends any significant time outdoors, whether it's hunting or farming or anything, who would argue with me on that point. And I've talked with a lot of people who, you know, don't believe climate change is real. And I've said, well, yeah, but what about the storms? Aren't they getting worse? Aren't the seasons changing? Well, yeah, yeah. But, you know, and then we have a discussion from that point on. But I feel pretty confident that, you know, when it comes down to the lowest common denominator, everyone understands that things, that the weather patterns and the climate is changing. Now, where it gets bogged down is with the politicians. You know, they don't want to do anything about it, or they say they do to rile up their base. But when it comes down to it, they'll use, you know, inflammatory rhetoric to basically charge up their base and then, you know, get it stuck in the political process.
The uncertainty where science intersects with politics is making planning difficult in an exacting field that has little tolerance for uncertainty. Engineering. Jake Allgaier is in hydraulics at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Louisville.
We've developed a whole suite of tools to access data and use current global climate models to kind of inform our design about what future conditions would look like. And really a key takeaway is that future projections of climate change have a lot of uncertainty with them. And that is where a lot of the difficulty comes from. It's not usually possible to design infrastructure to a worst case, an absolute worst case future condition. You know, if we did, that would be incredibly expensive. It wouldn't be a responsible use of taxpayer money. And so it's hard to imagine designing something for that worst case condition. So we're using the best available, best actionable science that we have to try to understand the uncertainty that comes with climate change and be strategic about our designs to accommodate that. And one approach that I think makes a lot of sense is to build adaptable features into our projects, into our engineering designs, so that they can be modified in the future and not be made obsolete by future conditions, but be adaptable to them and resilient to them.
The flood of 22 washed away some important guidelines of the past. It's estimated that 80% of the homes that were destroyed or badly damaged were not located in FEMA's officially designated floodplains. Colby Hall.
You know, what made this last round of flooding particularly unique is the fact that the majority of flooding came in areas that weren't in flood zones or floodplains.
necessarily, which, you know, it makes it really hard, right? Because these are areas, I guess, that haven't flooded before. So, yeah, I think, you know, thinking about how you can get to as high as ground as possible is on the top of everybody's mind. And that's hard to do over in the mountains. As you can imagine, you know, we're a little more limited there than maybe other places across the state and across the country.
Both of the region's area development districts, or ADDs as they're called, Kentucky River and Big Sandy, are in the process of updating their hazard mitigation plans. And it's yet to be known how the uncertainties brought by climate change will influence the ability to map out strategies. Michelle Allen is executive director of the Kentucky River ADD.
Majority of the projects that were listed in the 2017 plan had been addressed before the July flood. However, not a lot of them prevented the flood damage.
So what are the prospects? New housing will soon come up out of the ground on donated sites and not in Perry counties, and there may be more land soon. But it's not just about housing. From my conversation with Joe Jacobs, Economic Development Director at the Big Sandy Area Development District in Prestonsburg, what are the district's most important challenges, would you say, to economic development?
Really, our biggest challenge right now is the availability of ready buildings and ready building sites. We have industries that are interested in the area that would locate here fairly quickly if we had a place to put them. So that's why it's important for us to keep developing our industrial parks and developing buildings of a suitable size that will attract these industries.
That's the focus at the Southeast Kentucky Economic Development Corporation in Somerset, where Brett Traver is executive director.
We're what's called a community development financial institution, meaning we're a non-traditional lender to small and medium-sized businesses. And about half of our portfolio is concentrated in manufacturing. We still believe that it's important to make things. It employs people, which is one of our key goals. And it adds a lot to the gross domestic product and tax base and things for our communities.
What about small businesses and the jobs they create? The Appalachian Impact Fund's Jeff Marietta.
The flood, you know, hit areas, 80% of which were not in the floodplain. And these areas are very specific. So downtowns like Whitesburg, Jackson, Hindman, Isom, those four downtowns received the bulk of the destruction from the floods in terms of the business community. And you might throw Fleming Neon in there as well, which is in Letcher County. And so, you know, those four or five towns, certainly it really impeded any more private investment and then also destroyed private investment that had been made in those communities. That said, people are rebuilding. They're coming back. Not everyone, but the anchor institutions, the longstanding businesses have committed and are taking action to come back, and some have already reopened.
Sabrina McWhorter is manager of business and innovation at SOAR.
You will see those people, those neighbors, the small businesses that have come out on the other side, and will look back and remember those who helped them throughout it, but also be able to be more prepared in case something happens down the road. And that resiliency that just interweaves everyone together, I think that's going to build back a stronger and more prepared community, as well as really, to the core, create a positive effect across all the counties. Even though they're hurting now, I think 10 to 15 years from now, they're going to look back and say, you know, we went through a really rough thing, but we've overcome it and we've been able to move on, and there's been some positive impact.
The feedback from site location professionals tells us that while factory floors are essential ingredients of a strong local economy, so is quality of life. Again, Jeff Marietta.
You have to do both, right? You have to both try to attract outside investment and build the backbone of the small business community. And for so long, the economic development approach has been pray to the factory gods, and maybe a factory will relocate here. And you can't do that and watch your downtown crumble.
It's hardly a secret that Eastern Kentuckians are not real keen on hearing from outside of the region about how to live their lives, run their businesses, shape their communities, and who is. But if attracting new business and people are important to bringing new prosperity to the region, what can be learned by listening to the third-party, dispassionate perspectives of site location professionals who are, by and large, located in urban areas? Haley McCoy, the executive director of the Kentucky Economic Development Association and a native of McKee in Jackson County.
Even those of us who've worked economic development projects understand that there are layers in that process. And so you may come in the beginning or you may come in at the end, but few people see the entire scope of a project from start to finish. And what we're seeing more and more of now, I mentioned place, the importance of place. We're seeing site consultants on behalf of companies inquiring about that, inquiring about quality of life in the community where the company seeks to locate, because companies are made up of people and people want to live in good communities. So some of these requests for information or RFIs that come in have increasingly had questions about diversity, questions about the ethnic makeup of the community. How many minorities do you have in your community? How many of these people are in leadership? What are you doing to promote that sense of inclusion within your community? And for some of our communities, like where I'm from, that's a hard thing to answer because we may not have a large number of diverse population, people of diverse backgrounds who either live there or are in leadership. So we're wanting to create, I'm in the process of collaborating with our community foundation, Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, ARC, the Brushy Fork Institute at Berea College, to look at an adaptive leadership model that would help communities grapple with that. What can we say to a site selector? How can we answer an RFI that says, we may not have these numbers, but we're a place that welcomes people. We want all people to come and find their place here in our community so that when these economic development opportunities come by, we're not overlooked. We're not bypassed because we don't know how to answer the question.
This is not lost on business owners in the region. So is Sabrina McWhorter.
In order for these types of manufacturing to relocate to these outer parts of Kentucky, they're going to have to bring and create a community to where people are able to shop, stay, and play. And so our small businesses work each day to not only build their business up, but they also are involved in their community and creating a better opportunity to attract visitors with tourism and things like that.
Similar thoughts at Southeast Kentucky Economic Development in Somerset, where Brett Travers is executive director.
We need the things that make our community strong. The coffee shop where people gather and meet, to the restaurant, to the boutique where people, you know, find something that they can't get anywhere else. Tourism, all of those things play into building a vibrant region.
So has a major natural disaster become a catalyst? Haley McCoy.
I'm glad to have the opportunity to learn more about what site selectors are saying, you know, really helping us see ourselves on that global stage, at least the regional North American stage of competition, that when people are looking for places to start a business, expand a business, when other Kentucky companies are saying, I want a second location, where should I go? That communities that really care about this sort of thing, because it ultimately impacts quality of life, which impacts the people running the business. But it's going to matter that we have good processes in place, that we do care about our environment, our communities that children are growing up in. And I think we're ready for that.
Efforts are underway to find the money it takes to make things happen in a big way. As the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky's Jerry Roll suggested, this requires vision, planning. Among the organizations out looking for capital to put plans into action is Invest Appalachia, a blended capital impact investment fund seeded by the Appalachian Regional Commission and now into its sixth year.
Primarily focusing in clean energy, community health, food and agriculture, and creative placemaking.
Baylen Campbell is the organization's hazard-based director of community impact.
Our lead investors are United Healthcare and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, in conjunction with a number of other key investors like the Appalachian Regional Commission, Cassiopeia Foundation, Laughing Gull, and others. That's on our investment side. And on the nonprofit side, we have a broad spectrum of philanthropic investors, primarily national investors or those who don't have a geographic footprint in the region.
And as Campbell, a hazard native, points out, this is not a top-down approach.
Our goal and structure is to bring private investment into the region, paired with philanthropic dollars that we refer to as catalytic capital, to invest in new projects, new businesses, new sectors that the community wants to see. So we are a fund that is accountable to community. We have a built-in community accountability mechanism, which is our community advisory council, which is made up of a really wonderful, diverse group of folks who do community and economic development across the region.
Another goal, according to Campbell, is to bring some fundamental changes to the national philanthropic investment pecking order.
There was a 2017 report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that noted that Central Appalachia receives $41 on per capita in national grant making, which compares to the national average of $451 per capita. And historically, Central Appalachia has received less than 1% of overall venture capital investment. So it's about how we can utilize investment dollars and philanthropic support to invest in our people so that we can build healthier communities, build community wealth, and then build community power at the same time, so that Appalachia can tell its own story more effectively and shape its own future, or how we're reverse engineering the history of extraction, which has impeded the equitable growth of the region's economy.
Campbell says turning around that imbalance begins with how the region presents itself.
Really just asking ourselves, what story do we want to tell? What does success look like in the region? And how is that in alignment with a broader collective vision of what the future of Appalachia should look like?
Well, many have been arguing for years that Appalachian Kentucky should tell a different, more positive story about itself, and there have been many efforts to present that story of the region. Significant fruits of those efforts, however, were among the casualties of the flood. Mandy Fugit-Scheffel owns the Red Spotted Newt bookstore in Hazard, but on the night of the flood, she was in Hindman.
I personally was at Hindman Settlement School the night of the flood. I was at the Appalachian Writers Workshop. So I was there, and knowing that the archives were in the basement and seeing that the basement was completely underwater and feeling like we had lost all that history. And I think maybe what people don't understand who aren't from this region is that Appleshop and Hindman Settlement School are cornerstones of Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia as a whole. They hold a lot of our history. And especially with like Apple Shop, a lot of theirs is visual. You know, they have a lot of movies and documentaries that have been made about Appalachia. And it's kind of like we have been responsible for chronicling our own history. You know, I mean, it's been our responsibility to document our history. And these are the two critical institutions where this happened. You know, it was Apple Shop and Hindman Settlement School. I mean, they held the history of Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia in those buildings. So I think it was a huge loss for our culture and our heritage as a people here to lose those things.
But in the end, attracting investment comes down to what the rest of the world thinks when they hear the term Appalachia. Bailey Richards, the Hazard Downtown Coordinator.
You hear about Bloody Breathitt, and you hear about, you know, the War of Black Mountain and all these different things. And so they get this kind of rap of being this kind of like dangerous, lawless area, which is absolutely not true.
Invest Appalachia's Baylen Campbell.
You know, I don't have a background in finance, so I can't speak to all the details of how investors and bankers assess risk. But we're all well aware that investment in Central Appalachia outside of a few key priorities historically has always been deemed as risky in one form or fashion. I think a lot of that is due to negative, tired, out-of-date stereotypes of the region. And that has also impacted the philanthropic support in the region as well.
So, okay, let's talk about those perceptions. We know about the Beverly Hillbillies, Hee Haw, Mayberry, RFD, but those cringeworthy representations happened years ago.
Part of the way that the Appalachian stereotype gets to continue is that it's known and it's usual, and to keep people listening in and watching, especially these TV shows, they need to play to what people already know.
Carolyn Schutt, in her senior year at Transylvania University, made a study of what's keeping the stereotype alive today.
So if people maybe have some kind of idea that Eastern Kentucky or Appalachians abide with a certain set of characteristics, then they have to keep playing to those to continue to be popular. So there's real no incentive to change how they're viewing people. And also what I learned that was really interesting was that they attempted to create a real-life reality show version of the Beverly Hillbillies, where they would actually take families from Eastern Kentucky and move them out to California in sort of a, like, real-life, like, culture shock experience. It was shut down fairly quickly by people from the region. It's one of the only cases where they're listened to, but it's just another example of how nationally this has become a profitable narrative. And without people from the region speaking out at a national level that are being listened to, then there's a gap in that representation.
So what drives this? Why does it persist?
Part of that, like I mentioned earlier, is when audiences know something to be true, there's no real incentive to change that narrative or change the culture of it, because as people innately, we don't like change necessarily. So with this culture industry, television producers and sort of content controllers will keep playing to these same narratives to keep people interested. And in a larger sense to try to, you know, sell advertising and make money off of these representations. So it's less about telling truthful stories and more about keeping people interested in viewing and making money off of Appalachian representation.
Well, here's a story we'd like to tell. Eastern Kentucky is today a place forced by circumstance to make some big adjustments. And as Chris Begley pointed out, it's hardly the first time that's happened. The flood of July 27 and 28, 2022 is the latest. Living beyond the 45 lives that it took are the changes it brought. Letting go of a deeply rooted, exceptional love of place as floodplain communities are relocated to new homes on higher ground. Public and private investments in getting more remote corners of the region online and notifiable when storms approach. Investments in badly needed repairs and upgrades to water and sewer systems, in new bridges designed to withstand extreme weather, in better roads. It takes time for federal funds to find their way to intended projects. Recovery takes time, patience, and an openness to things not quite as they were. But there is one thing that we've heard throughout this series that we hope can be preserved. You might call it Eastern Kentucky's special sauce, something we hear too little of these days, it seems. We've heard it from Whitney Bailey, the Apple-Red attorney who relocated from Lexington to Prestonsburg.
The people down here absolutely make up for it because they're so kind and absolutely would give you the shirt off their back if you asked them to, a stranger. It's really cool. I love it.
And from Jeff Marietta at the Appalachian Impact Fund.
Generally, I think the people here, and I'm not from here, you know that, are very, very, very loving, very accepting, and want to get to know you and want to know about you. but they don't want to be looked down on.
Haley McCoy sees it in her work in economic development.
We know, as we face hardships, what good people we have in Kentucky, all across Kentucky. Western Kentucky has experienced this as well. We see the goodness of our people shine, and folks reach out to serve and to help. And suddenly those county lines start to get really blurry.
Bailey Richards grew up in Cincinnati, lived in Louisville, now downtown coordinator in Hazard.
It's just so encouraging to just see a whole group of people just really loving the place that they are and wanting to be there.
Mimi Pickering has seen it through her documentarian's lens.
It's been kind of amazing to see how concerned and giving people have been. Like we've talked to folks who have literally lost their home, and you know, they're talking about their concern for their neighbor.
At the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, Jerry Roll.
You know, that's a part of our culture that I hope we never lose. That we don't just take care of ourselves, we take care of each other. And we do that to the best of our ability.
And Special Projects reporter Corinne Boyer found it in the libraries.
On a clear winter day, Owsley County Library Director Lisa Markham opens a large green shipping container.
Shoes, clothes, there's bedding back there. I've got a couple of mattresses.
Two shipping containers sit behind the library. One holds supplies for people who were flooded in July of last summer. The other contains similar supplies. It's for people in need.
I have toothbrushes. I have laundry soap. I have cleaning supplies. I have a few pillows left. I have some use covers. I have some coats.
Libraries don't usually keep shipping containers stocked with supplies, but Markham doesn't think of herself as a typical librarian. If someone asks her for something, whether they need help accessing the internet or need a hot meal, Markham finds a way to help.
When I was giving the food out, this one couple asked me if I had a cooking stove. I'm like, no. But they knew Miss Lisa at the library might know somebody, and they know I don't care to ask. So that's one of my goals, is to get them a stove.
Markham delivered meals to survivors for 3 weeks straight after the flood. But floods and poverty have been a constant in her community for the past several years. She's lost count of the number of FEMA applications she's filled out. The Owsley County Library wasn't flooded, but like other libraries, it provides services to help people affected by last year's flood. When you stand in front of the Perry County Library in Hazard, you'd probably never guess it was flooded. From downtown Hazard, you have to drive up a steep road to reach the library, but a mountain sits behind it. Library Director Sheila Lindsay watched the water rise on the building's security cameras.
So we have a dock system back here that carries the water out. But what happened during the flooding is, as you can see, it comes off the mountainside and then it comes down. And our drain system could not handle the amount of water that came off the mountain.
Only a minimal amount of water spread through part of the library. The repairs are nearly completed. After the flood, big dehumidifiers ran throughout the library, but water didn't reach the front half of the building. Despite the damage, the Perry County Library became a place of respite.
So we didn't know what else to do but set up a reference table, start giving people FEMA, printing things out, coloring sheets for the kids. We set up cooling stations. We had like charging stations where people could come in and charge their devices. Facebook and things for family, wanting to know if everybody was okay, you know, they didn't live here.
The library's 170-seat auditorium became a movie theater.
We would leave this open, like just wide open, and show movies all day long, every single day. Because people were just, I don't know, the mental strain of that flood, we're still feeling it.
It continues to show movies every Saturday, because Lindsay says the flood damaged the town's only movie theater. One service provided by the library turned out to be essential when people had nowhere else to go.
You said you didn't know why they built showers when they built this library.
I really don't. I was very thankful for those showers, but I don't know why we had showers, but I'm thankful that we did have showers because they came in handy.
As recovery continues, Lindsay is now working with Buckhorn Elementary students to collect stories and photos. One photo shows floodwaters nearly touching the roof of Buckhorn Elementary School. The students now attend A.B. Combs Elementary.
And we're going to turn them into books. And then we're going to try to get every school in the area that wants to do it to do the same. And then we're going to have for our genealogy collection.
Although the library flooded, Lindsay says she's especially grateful that the genealogy collection survived. None of the library's collections were lost. In Knott County, the library wasn't as lucky. About 4.5 feet of water destroyed all 25,000 items, along with the walls, the electrical system, and the library's genealogy collection.
And a lot of the books that were written from, people around here, the close family genealogy, and I don't even know if all those people are still living now or if you can buy those books.
That's Knott County Library Director Tammy Owens. Although it's a major loss, Owens says some people have already talked about replacing materials lost with copies of local family genealogy. Crews are currently working to repair the library. Owens expects it to reopen in June or July. For now, the library is set up in an old pharmacy. The temporary space is stocked with books, furniture, and computers.
Lexington Public Library gave us a lot of the computers and desks, and Floyd County Library gave us that table, and Lexington gave us a lot of books, and just people, they just come in, they donate books.
Right now, if people want to check out books, Owen says,
give them to them.
Although it's a small gesture, it seems to be the norm for libraries in Eastern Kentucky. Even in the aftermath of a disaster, these libraries find ways to help their communities. For Eastern Standard on WEKU, I'm Corinne Boyer.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard series produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. This concludes our 6-week series about the consequences of the flood of July 22. Rise will continue to follow developments. There are houses to be built, neighborhoods to get situated, floodplains to be remapped, communication systems to reach the remote. There's a lot of planning ahead and preparing. But we will also continue looking into many other aspects of life in the WEKU broadcast regions of Appalachian and Central Kentucky. Mike Savage is our executive producer. Jean Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Chris Begley, associate producer and special topics reporter, Corinne Boyer, special projects reporter, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. From WEKU News, Stan Ingold, Stu Johnson, and John McGarry. Contributing to the series, the Mountain Eagles' Sam Adams, Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones, the reporters of the Daily Yonder, Anya Slepian, Carolyn Carlson, Claire Carlson, Joel Cohen, and Xander Brown. Rise is online at weku-rise.org, and you can contact us from the site. Eastern Standard's online home is esweku.org. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Rise, a production of Eastern Standard on WEKU.